I'm Chris McAdoo, and this is Enjoyable Listen Time with Best Behavior, where we talk to people who make things and make things happen. And, with any luck, inspire you to do the same.
Let's get started.
Let's get started.
So, Bill Foster is a frequent collaborator and a good friend of Best Behavior Creative, and we wanted to talk to him about not only what you're kind of currently working on, right? So, Bill has become, would you say, photographer to the stars.
Photographer to the mildly well-known.
There we go. But he's really made a name for himself, particularly with live concert photography. I mean, you've shot for, Margo Price was here last night. You've shot for her. You've shot for the Avett Brothers. Andrew Leahy.
And actually, both of those are good examples of my favorite thing. Those are both groups that I shot, like, at the Preservation Pub or at the Pilot Light, and from there to the main stage at Bonnaroo, you know. That's, or in Margot's amazing case, Forecastle. But
yeah. Well, and oh yeah, before I forget, over, if you're listening, and my stage left is also George Middlebrooks.
Hey
George. George is producing this thing and making sure the wheels stay on the tracks, right?
We still have levels, so yeah,
we go. But it's been really cool, probably from Bill's perspective, to see a lot of artists, you know, sort of start from the bottom and make it to literally and figuratively a larger stage.
Absolutely.
And probably to be able to do that, to be an artist, if you're a photographer, if you're a musician, it probably helps to follow what I will call Best Behavior's number one rule: don't be an asshole.
Don't be an asshole.
Would you agree?
I would absolutely agree. I've seen that in pretty much all walks of life, right?
Well, that was one of the things that I thought would be kind of interesting, is what a lot of people probably don't know about Bill, is that, Bill, you spent 21 years in the Navy?
Exactly, yep.
Tell me all the places that you have been.
Oh, I can't.
Well, maybe
I've been to 70 countries. Yeah. Although that's cheating and including like San Marino and Monaco and Vatican City. So, but still,
I would include those, right?
Yeah, but I lived in Europe for a really long time. I lived in Italy for 12 years, and I lived in Spain for 3 years, and I dated Italian girls before and after that. I have a son in Italy, so I've been going back and forth to Europe for even longer than that. And then the one thing that I like when I look back at my life is that I was in the Navy. And in the Navy, I did a lot of different jobs. I was an electronics technician, but later I became kind of a general assistant to people in Italy. And I worked in NATO my last 7 years. But then I've also worked at an electronics store. I managed like a Best Buy kind of thing. And I got all my degrees in my off time in political science, and then so I've taught political science, and I taught at UT, and I also taught like floating around on an aircraft carrier for the Navy as a civilian. So I've been in the Navy as an enlisted man and then as an officer / civilian. And then I worked for a nanotechnology company for 7 years, which is actually where I visited the majority of the countries, was when I was working for them. And now I'm an artist with quotes around that. So
you don't have to.
No,
you
don't have to quote that.
So it's nice, you know. I don't think that there are many people that have been in the military and been in retail and been in an academic institution and been in a technology company and been a self-employed artist. And in pretty much every one of those fields, don't be an asshole should be a cardinal rule. And I was an asshole for a large part of my life until I was, I don't know, 35 or 36 before I pulled my head out of my ass. And
so, it's an expensive surgery.
Hey, me too.
I think there's probably times in all of our both personal and professional lives where like you're not on the good side of that argument, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
So what are, I mean, you know, sort of historically, I want to hear some, you know, some thoughts about in a situation, you know, when you were, you know, maybe in the Navy, where someone was, you know, being a jerk, they were not treating people with respect, they were not, you know, know, all the things that sort of what an asshole means, and a situation goes poorly.
Yeah, it just always, I mean, it always comes back to bite you in the end. I mean, if you treat people well, then you're going to be treated well. That's, I mean, one of the sea changes that I made in my life was just like, I don't know, maybe like 10 years ago, I just decided I was just not ever going to worry about whether people reciprocate things or not. You know, I would take pictures for people. I would give it to them. Hopefully people would pay me. But if I give people pictures and they don't say thank you and everything, I wasn't going to worry about it. My actions define me. And by giving stuff, that's a good thing to do. And I hope that makes me a better person. And I'm not going to worry about whether it's reciprocated or not, because it's just, it's fruitless. Right. And I think, I don't know, to me, that's, you just have to try to be a good person. So I was thinking with this guy in the Navy. So I worked I was a radiation control petty officer, which means I worked in a nuclear support facility, and I controlled the entrances and egresses from it and made sure people were decontaminated and looked for contamination and everything, and made, you know, check dosimeters and that kind of thing. And I actually built, it was a fun job. I built plastic containments around things. So, you know, when you want to work on a valve, you have to build a plastic box around it, and you have to have gloves in it. You know, you have holes for gloves, and you have to have, and everything has to be in that box. Because in the nuclear field, you have what's called verbatim compliance, which is way off subject, but it's fun, which means that you have to write down every single thing you're going to do. And if something's wrong, if it says to use a 3/4-inch wrench and you need a half-inch wrench, then you have to stop everything. You have to change a procedure, and it has to be signed by 20 people, jeez, by every single person. And you can't move on until you've corrected the written procedure and every single person is signed off. So when you were building these plastic things, it was really important that everything be in there, that you have the right amount of pockets, the right amount of glove holes and everything. Because otherwise, the whole friggin' thing operation stops.
And 3 glove holes doesn't make any sense.
No. Actually, there are circumstances, but we won't get into that. But so, I guess the reason that is a little bit relevant, because the point of it is that it's a really high-stress occupation. Not so much because of the, I mean, because we're not really talking about real radiation or anything. It's all really harmless. But just because of the paperwork and the stress involved, and people are working till midnight. And so officers in that field tend to be really bad. Also, because officers in that field are really smart. They're really, really smart. They're the smartest people in the U.S. military. And because they're the smartest people in the U.S. military, they tend to go somewhere else and get paid more money quickly. Mm. So the ones that stay in tend to not be the very best ones. And there was, and so,
the Peter principle.
Exactly. And I mean, and there was one that was just chair throwing. His name was Doug. But literally, it's the only time in my life I've actually had someone throw a chair across the room.
Wow.
At me.
Like Bobby Knight style, throw a chair at you.
Threw a chair, teaching a class, keep in mind. So one thing, because in the nuclear field, you have to take a test every week. And then you have to take a big, like, written essay thing, like, once every 2 months. And so you're always taking classes every day to keep prepared for these tests and everything. And so he was teaching one of those, and, man, just lost it. And he was always just freaking out about little things. And nobody supported him. And he didn't really get the work out of the crew that he could have gotten out of it, because people would do things like write "Who stole my strawberries" on the chalkboard when he left. Not that I had anything to do with that.
Of course not.
But yeah, and he was just it was painful to see. Like, well, a person that I really absolutely despise, as much as you can despise somebody without knowing them, is Steve Jobs. Because I think Steve Jobs made it okay to be an asshole.
Yeah.
Steve.
Yeah.
I think he would, you know, he would have done all the same things, accomplished just as much, and could have been nice. And so because of his example, people who want to be that way because they're power-hungry assholes.
That's the path you've got to carve for yourself.
Yeah, now they have a license to do that.
Well, there's so many. I hear a lot of stories about, you know, folks like back in the tech boom, you know, days where entrepreneurs, business people, if you were in any side of this kind of the industry, it was assumed that that's how you were supposed to be. And I wonder how much, not just from, you know, like, I'm Steve Jobs and I'm going to make Apple and here's your iPhone kind of a thing, but, you know, any company that looks up to that brand of leader.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because you're going to try to, you know, how many people tried to emulate that style of leadership, but did not have the thing that I think made, you know, it could be argued one way or the other, that made somebody like Steve Jobs a success almost in opposition to what he was doing was because of his vision and because of what he wanted to do. So what happens when you're a leader and you have a bad vision or not one at all, but you're still acting like that to people?
Right.
You know,
and it's important to distinguish between being nice doesn't mean you can't fire somebody. It doesn't mean you can't hold people accountable, right?
Yeah.
It's important to criticize. For instance, for me as an artist, for instance, it's very difficult for me to get objective criticism because everybody just kisses your ass and says, "Oh, your photographs are great." Blah blah blah.
You know who's being honest.
Yeah, and you can't improve.
Yeah.
So finding people, and Chris is one who will tell you, "Hey, your work is not up to standard in this area." That's a really valuable thing, and Chris can do it without being an asshole. Right.
Thanks, guys.
but it's serious because that's what gives you motivation to get better.
Well,
actually,
that's a great kind of a part of a conversation because particularly for anybody in the creative field, if you're a designer, if you're a photographer, if you're, anything like that, you have to be able to both take and give criticism in a way that is constructive and meaningful.
Mm-hmm.
And I think particularly in the creative field, the criticism can devolve very quickly into personal things.
Well, it is personal, right? And that's the thing. So you have to accept it as like, I mean, in any artistic field, I mean, what you're doing is you. And I guess other fields are like that too. But you know, your work is uniquely personal. So when someone criticizes your work, it is a personal criticism.
Sure.
But, you know, you have to think about it and decide for yourself and honestly critique the criticism and think, is this valid? Can I learn from this? And so it's not that you can't take it personally, but I mean, I guess what I'm kind of saying is don't take it personally, but it's impossible not to. It's like you have to.
There's a person in there.
Kind of filter it within yourself. Like, you know, it's still going to go to your heart, but your brain also has to take over and say, well, I've still got to get this right.
It's a duality. You have to maintain two things. One of my favorite Springsteen things that he ever said was that his whole life is this duality where you have to go out on stage and think, I am the biggest damn rock star in the world, and all these people are here to see me, and I'm going to kill this. And you have to be like, it's just another day at the office.
Yeah.
Be calm and just go out and do it. And you have to maintain these two contradictory thoughts in your head at the same time. And I guess that's what I'm saying about accepting criticism. It is personal. It's going to hurt a little bit. But at the same time, you have to step back from it and be objective and analyze whether you can learn from it and whether it's valid or not, whether the person is being an asshole or not.
Yeah.
Well, all right. Let's kind of transition a little bit from – so we've gone from – Navy times, experiences, kind of things that happened there. And what made you decide that you were going to start becoming a photographer, thus opening yourself up to criticism that you may or may not have been prepared for at that time, right?
I don't think I ever decided to become a photographer. I mean, you know, so I always took pictures. You know, and I wanted to be better. So it's a good story, Katrique. My first love, Sylvia Arlandini. Hi, Sylvia.
Hey, Sylvia.
You guys want to say hi to her?
Hey, Sylvia.
I took these pictures of Florence, and they were like the first pictures I ever took with a camera, and they were crap. You know, underexposed because I was taking pictures of, you know, a bright sky and a city, and so the city was all in shadow and the sky was overexposed. It was crap, but I liked them because Florence is a beautiful place and you can't mess up the pictures that bad. But I showed them to Sylvie and she was as polite and nice as could be while she ripped my heart out. And she said something like, you know, well, you know, I'm from here and I've seen lots and lots of pictures of it, so maybe I'm just a little jaded and, you know, I don't know. They're just not quite what I'm used to seeing.
So this is going well so far, yeah.
So I wanted to get better. But I didn't like using film. Like, I never liked developing film. I was never into chemicals. I didn't like that. But when I took it to the lab, I always got inconsistent results. It was never my work. And I was like, well, it depends on the lab, and I don't like that. I want it to be mine. So so I just didn't. I took a bunch, but, you know, I just didn't do much with them until I got digital. And then I got digital, and I was in Kosovo at the time. And I got this really nice Sony. And
this would have been when?
2000.
Okay.
So, and there were all these Serbian Orthodox churches that were in danger of being, that were in Albanian territory and were in danger of being burned down any time. And they were these incredible works of art. And I really wanted to document them because, you know, they might not be there the next day. And so I just went around in my spare time as much as it was safe to do and when I could get an escort and just took pictures of all these churches just because I just wanted there to be a record of them. And so that when then in order to do it, it was kind of technical and difficult because they were all dark with all these bright colors inside all these dark rooms. And I just started learning to do it. And I also learned, you know, the main thing, what people don't understand about being a photographer is that pushing buttons is the least bit of it, right? That's the easy part. Being a photographer is talking to people. It's making connections.
Yeah.
Getting access to places to shoot, you know, talking your way into places, climbing into difficult places, making people feel comfortable. Like, and that's why I'm not a wedding photographer. I do weddings a year. I have openings. But but I'll never be a great wedding photographer because I don't really make the brides feel comfortable in the way that really great wedding photographers make them
comfortable. There's a lot of psychology to that.
Right, and that's the main skill. The main skill is the pushing the camera and everything. That's nice, but it's making the bride feel comfortable because that's what makes the picture exceptional.
Yeah.
Right? It's not, no matter what you do with the camera, if the bride isn't comfortable, it's not going to be a good picture. Right?
Well, so being able to recognize in that sense what you're to sort of recognize your strengths, recognize where you need to improve, but knowing that as a creative person, some people will assume like, what kind of camera do you have? Do you ever get, what are you shooting with?
Yeah.
You know,
doesn't,
I mean,
matter.
Yeah.
And
it's always like, yeah, you know, man, your guitar plays good solos.
And you want to hand it to him and say, yeah, it sure does.
Yeah, go for it, man.
Show me.
Yeah, well, that's when you get that. Yeah, I get that comment about once a month. Man, your camera takes good pictures.
That's tough. To anybody out there listening, don't say that. That's kind of an asshole that's move. I think as a, again, kind of like as a creative person, again, a photographer, an artist, whatever, even we take for granted, I think, the skills behind that machine. Because now we can hide behind a lot of technology, right? I mean, we can have fancier cameras, more expensive guitars, bigger paintbrushes. I don't know.
Yeah,
maybe.
Why not?
But I think that is always going to be a crutch for folks, you know, that don't want to sort of take responsibility for your talent, take responsibility for what you have to offer to people. Right.
And this, I mean, this gets at the core mission, I think, of Best Behavior Creative Club, which is that, and one day cameras are going to be able to do everything. You know, 10 years from now, cameras are going to just take a picture and give you 20 selected crops and 20 selected exposures and high dynamic range, everything. And that will be good enough for most people. But there will always be a place, because what you're selling as a photographer, if you're a good one, is yourself and your brand. You're selling your vision. You're selling the way you do things. You're selling your creativity. You're selling your personality. You're selling that, you know, you're a good person to work with, that you're going to show up on time, you're going to do your job, you're going to be quick, you're going to finish. But also that you're, you know, a good person to be stuck going to, for instance, 5 schools in Page County, Virginia in a day. And you know, you're selling a brand. And there will always be room for that. And that's the part of it that makes you an artist, right? Anybody can point a camera and do something, but hopefully, as a photographer, you're going to see something that the average person doesn't see. And you're going to see it in a different way and think of something. And And that's nerve-wracking, you know, when I, especially like, you know, like I've been in situations like Stevie Wonder where I had, you know, I had 45 seconds to shoot him,
man.
You know, Slayer at Bonnaroo. I had half a song with, you know,
jeez. Oh my gosh.
People jumping in.
In a Slayer kind of situation.
Yeah. I mean, people all yeah. bright red light, people flying over my head. Literally, there was a bug on my neck that I just grabbed it like that and it landed on Carrie's. What's Kerry King? It landed on Kerry King's leg. So the whole rest of the time I was shooting, I'm waiting for him to notice that there's this bug on his leg that I put there. But you know, and so you can't panic, but it, you know, and it's silly to say that photography can be pressure. But you have like 45 seconds and you've got to get a shot for the newspaper that's good enough of Stevie Wonder. And he's Stevie Wonder. You can't just say, hey, can you come here? Can you
come over
like
here?
One second.
Yeah, yeah.
Can we try that again?
Look at me. Well, and you're also squeezed in with 200 other people who are trying to get shots too, and yours has to stand out.
Yep.
And that's where your heart comes in and
exactly.
your eye and like your you-ness.
And your elbows.
Yeah.
No, actually, you know, that's not really fair though. In keeping with this don't be an asshole thing. A place where there are remarkably few assholes, believe it or not, is photo pits at big music festivals.
Really?
Like you would think that something like Bonnaroo is all people shoving and everything, and there's generally like one or two new kids with holding up their iPad or something who are writing for some blog who don't really know the etiquette.
Lucky to be there.
Which, by the way, but, again, regular advice to just regular people.
Leave your iPad at home.
Please don't bring an iPad to a concert. That is not – there is no time, way, shape, or form that is cool.
None.
Nope.
But actually, everybody is pretty nice. You know, most people, well, they're conscious of people around them. It's, you know, it's really bad form to hold your camera up over your head. But if you do it, you know, because you have to sometimes, especially if you're short like me. You know, that guy for Rolling Stone is like 6'8", has it made. But for me, it's tough, you know. So, but you look behind you, hold your camera up. If you have a prime spot with your elbows on the stage, you shoot for a minute and a half, 2 minutes, you know, not a whole song. And then you move and you let somebody else in there. And you move, and you know, and everybody is pretty polite. Everybody, you know, you generally, if you have a backpack, you're conscious of your backpack, and you look, and you don't swing around really fast. And yeah, they're much more orderly than you think they are.
So it sounds like, you know, the kind of environment where everybody is there to hopefully do the best job that they can.
Right.
And they're willing to help the guy next to them also do the best job.
Yeah, it's not cutthroat at all.
Yeah.
You know? So that really surprised me because I thought it would be a lot of before, like, especially I remember the first time I went on the main stage at Bonnaroo, I really thought that was going to be, you know, a really hectic,
like a dog
chaotic dogfight environment. Not at all. You know,
who was the first one you shot? Who is the first one you shot at Bonnaroo? Who's the first artist you shot on the main stage?
Oh, on the main stage.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. The first artist I shot was Nikki Bloom and the Gamblers. I remember that.
Nice.
Like at noon on a Thursday, because she was the first artist that played and the first Bonnaroo I went to. I don't remember who was the first on the... Like, I don't do the main stage a whole lot because I don't need to. And especially the main stage at Bonnaroo is tough for me because it's really tall and there's these really big subwoofers. And because I'm short, I can only shoot from in between the subwoofers unless, you know. And... Those three nights, like I shoot the main stages at every other festival, but Bonnaroo, those three nights are really special to me. The 9 o'clock shows, because I shoot 75 shows at Bonnaroo usually, but I want to have a little fun. So those three shows, the 9 o'clock Friday, Saturday, and Sunday shows, I usually prefer to be out in the crowd with
you
my friends.
Watch.
Yeah,
good for you.
But I've shot Elton John, Kendrick Lamar. Florence and the Machine, and she was great. She came over and stood right over. I couldn't get to her because of those big subwoofers and everything, and she walked over to the subwoofers and stood up on a concrete plinth. She was barefooted, and her toes were, like, right here, right next to my forehead. The picture was actually shit crap because she was too close.
PG-13.
Yeah.
Well, so, because hopefully... you know, we can, hopefully, you know, folks listening may want to learn more about Bill, right? And so anybody can go to BillFosterPhotos.com. That's all your stuff, right? But before we kind of send everybody off, is if you were talking to somebody that was...
You said BillFosterPhotos.com, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
BillFosterPhotos.com.
Yeah. or KnoxBillPhotos.com.
Okay.
They go to the same place.
Cool. But before we send, you know, folks off to check that out, let's just say that, you know, somebody comes up to Bill Foster. They're a young photographer, young creative person. That doesn't even have to be a photographer. Just somebody that wants to create for the entirety of their life. They want to make something. What is a piece of advice that you would... I know we've been talking about people like, you know, don't be an asshole, which is, you know, rule number one. In that spirit, what kind of advice would you give a young person trying to make it on, you know, trying to make stuff?
Inherit a lot of money.
Damn it. We're still working on it.
No, you know, I mean, as it turns out, taking pictures of people who don't have money isn't the best business model. But just do it. Don't waste your money on crap, right? That's the best advice I can give a young person. I wasted a lot of money on silly stuff when I was young. And you know what? You can go to Europe for 2 weeks when you're 20 years old. I have 20 friends, at least, that have done it in the last year that are 21, 22, 24 years old, have no money. But you know what? They didn't, you know, they buy their clothes at thrift stores. They're sitting on a used sofa that they found on sitting on Broadway. They drink PBR instead of craft beer when they go out. They don't go to a lot of concerts. They go to a lot of movies. They save their money because they prioritize having a life over having things, and they make sound decisions. And if you look, man, there's all kinds of, you know, websites and everything about how to do things really on the cheap. And I mean, that's the best advice I can give. You know, if you're going to be an artist, you're not going to be rich, statistically speaking. You know, there's a few who make it, Chris McAdoo, but but you know, it's hard to get to a place where you're selling your pictures for, you know, where you can sell a painting for $5,000. It's great when you get to that level, but it's hard to get to that level, and not everybody, the vast majority of artists never make it to that level. And you're going to be living with uncertainty. Like, I don't have that much booked now, but most of my bookings come up with, you know, 3 days notice.
Right.
And so, you know, I just kind of have to trust that something will go up, but something will turn up, but that means living in a, you know, a constant state of anxiety.
Well, at this point, I think that's a constant state for most people. Yeah. But, well, what I have, you know, what that means to me is, you know, what I've heard from your, you know, beginning career to now, you've traveled all over the world, you've met a lot of people, you've done a lot of amazing things. But what I hear most as sort of that thread, right, that goes through is relationships.
Yep.
People matter to you. You matter to people. And it's not always transactional.
Yeah. I'll give you a good example. So when I was in Verona, Italy, I lived in this – not lived. Well, I did live there sometimes because we did 24-hour shifts. But in this communication circuit for if there was ever a nuclear war. And it was this underground bunker that we had to walk through a quarter-mile tunnel under a mountain to get to. Freezing cold because it had doors at both ends and the wind would whip through there. But anyway, so I had to go into this big thing underground called West Star. And they decided to do a military exercise there for some reason. And so this giant complex that really only like six rooms were used and really only the coffee bar and the mess hall were used. But this giant thing, we had to renovate. And we're talking like we had to build like these giant control rooms that you see like in nuclear missile movies, you know, with like 50 computer screens. We had to build one of those.
What?
And like,
so like Matthew Broderick.
Yeah. So we had to install.
Dr. Strangelove.
We had to install 100 computers and all the networking and all the fiber optic and all the cable and everything in this bunker that had been built in 1940.
Wow.
And we had to do it in a month. And the two people that were in charge of it, Sean Coyle and Kevin Hayes, are just two of the nicest folks I ever worked for. And they were just tremendously great people, the kind of people that make the military what it is, just senior non-commissioned officers who got along with people and who knew how to put a team together and knew how to make it work. So it was a thoroughly pleasant, you know, it wasn't pleasant. We worked hard, but it was fine, you know, because nobody was throwing chairs and nobody was being an asshole. And that was because of good leadership. And so the guy, the lieutenant on the ship who threw the chair, I don't even remember his name. I remember his first name was Doug. I don't even remember his last name. I'd like to call him out and call him an asshole, but I honestly don't even remember. And that's the point. Assholes fade from your life, right? I don't remember this guy. Sean and Kevin, I'm still in touch with. One of them's in Tampa, one of them's in Norfolk. And they're great, great people. And that's what it's about. And the kind of people, when you aren't an asshole, then you can build relationships, you know? People who are assholes, they're generally people who call other people assholes. You know, that's the saying. So if you, if you think one person's an asshole, then maybe they're an asshole. But if you think all 10 people that you work with are assholes, you're a problem.
Perhaps you're the problem.
That's great, man. Well, I want to thank Bill Foster, everybody out there in internet land just clapped, right? There you go. There's one. There we go. But I really want to thank Bill Foster. Again, a great a friend, a photographer, a frequent collaborator. You can find his stuff, BillFosterPhotos.com, as well as KnoxBillPhotos.com.
Yep. It's the same website. So
it's the same thing. But just a good guy to deal with and somebody that we're going to have on again, definitely to talk more specifically about, you know, Florence and the Machine and Stevie Wonder, and we're going to get into a lot more of that, and we'll be happy to have him. So, again, this is Chris McAdoo with Best Behavior. We've been talking to Bill Foster, and thanks to George Middlebrooks.
Yeah.
Yeah, for holding the ship together. Making sure all the right. levels are leveling. All right. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. Check out the next installment, next podcast, and the next Days of Best Behavior, where you can share 21 Days of Best Behavior, hashtag 21 Days of Best Behavior, or check us out, wearebestbehavior.com. You can also hashtag Bill Foster, hashtag Bill Foster. Let's make you a trending
topic. Let's
make a
trend.
Hashtag Knox Bill Photos.
Oh, hashtag Knox Bill Photos. It's very topical. But thanks to Bill, and thanks to everybody for listening in.